When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Liquid Sky. One of the first films to explicitly depict and discuss pansexuality, androgyny, and genderqueerness in any substantial way. It is also an essay on toxic masculinity, ingrained homophobia, and the ingrained misogyny of both overground and underground culture. The film's hyper-stylized, neon-soaked aesthetic and aggressively bizarre, completely electronic score has continued to influence fashion, music, and pop culture in general since initial release in 1983. Oh, and on top of all that, it's a science fiction picture, and the male and female leads are played by the same person, queer icon Anne Carlisle, who joins myself and James St. James for this in-depth exploration of the themes, messages, and magic of Liquid Sky. Before we begin, though, it's time for the trigger warning. Liquid Sky does contain scenes of sexual assault, and in this episode, we do discuss all aspects of the film. As you can likely imagine, we do tread lightly, but there is no avoiding this subject matter. Regarding how to see this film, my recommendation is getting the Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray, which was lovingly restored and released a few years ago. Now, if you can't get a Blu-ray right now, if you're not in the position to, or maybe don't even have a Blu-ray player, which, by the way, what are you doing? Get a Blu-ray player. Poke around on the internet, you might even be able to find one on the old YouTubes, but promise me, you will not watch a rip of the VHS. Despite everyone loving the VHS aesthetic currently, it looks terrible on the VHS. Trust me, I had it. And if you want to see it on the big screen, it'll pop up now and then. There's a good chance the print is well-worn because it did play for years upon initial release. But in the last 2 years alone, I know that my favorite place, the New Beverly Cinema, as well as the Rio Cinema in Dalston, England, had screenings. Stick around after the main show to get a taste of what's coming next week on Movie Club Mondays. And now, time for my chat with Anne Carlisle and James St. James about Liquid Sky. Hi, Anne. How are you?
Well, I had a technical hiccup here at this end, too.
Okay, perfect.
I couldn't do it in the patio. It wouldn't work, so.
Well, this is a perfect scenario. Are those your artworks behind you?
Yes.
Well, that's even better than a patio, then. That's great.
There's another one over there. It's hard to see.
Yeah, it's okay, though, but it adds to the milieu, you know? And can you hear me okay? Yeah,
let me, I need more volume.
I can turn my volume up too, because I have,
Oh, great.
Is that good? Okay, yeah.
That's better, yeah.
Yeah, because I feed two separate recording devices, so I never know, and I don't hear the one I'm sending you, so that's why I have to check, because I don't want to also be sending distorted line and all that. So, thanks again for joining me for the Liquid Sky Movie Club. I missed that. What's that?
No, it's very nice to be here. I'm amazed that people still find it interesting after all this time.
Really? Yeah. I suppose that makes sense because you made the piece, right? So when you make the piece, sometimes it has sort of the same qualities as not necessarily yearbook photos or a piece that you made or something, but you view it in a completely different way and as a part of your past. But I think one of the many reasons it resonates today is that it's so of the time still when it talks about sexuality, gender roles, pansexuality in particular. I don't know if there's another film that actually said the words that you said in the film about... Oh, go ahead.
You have to understand that when, you know, before the movie happened, I was so isolated in my feelings, and I had hair like this, and I cut it all off, and I was running around in a mini skirt and men's shoes with a man's haircut. And, you know, of course, no one else was doing that. I was trying to find where I belonged. And I called myself an androgyn. Which there's no such thing. I just made it up. And I you know, I was running around to the clubs all the time. When we made the movie, I had to split that, you know, so it worked.
And when you say split that, because I heard you in another interview referring to the Margaret and Jimmy split as a split of yourself hatred. So I'm curious as to what your definition of split is. And I'd also like to welcome James St. James to the show.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Have we already started? Am I late?
No, we just started. But of course, you know how my show is. Like, we just start talking and then inevitably we get into the topic. But it's a perfect time for you to appear because we're talking about clubs and we'll get into everything pre that and post that. But of course, two more infamous and beloved denizens of the New York club scene of the early 80s couldn't be found more than you two.
I wanted to paint little squiggles on my face in honor of Anne, but I didn't have enough time. But I do think that my pajamas sort of look like the white mask.
Yes, white mask. I see that.
And I'm happy to see that we're all wearing patterns as well.
Down.
And I tried my best. I have the Hue lighting system, so I was, you know, I couldn't quite get the neon effect, but you know, just like the hazy pinky purple, it's as close as we can get.
Yeah.
And James, we get to see Anne's artwork behind her.
Let me see. Oh, nice. Oh, gorgeous.
I was set up in the patio, and I was going to show you the one I'm working on now. Unfortunately, it wasn't receiving any signal out there.
It
always did before, but you know, it's raining.
Right. Well, there could be an alien craft on the next building.
Yeah, that's right.
Where are you now, Anne?
Florida.
Oh, we're in Florida.
Boynton Beach.
Boynton. I'm a Fort Lauderdale girl. That's where I grew up.
Ah.
And my dad is in Tampa. So I go, so I'm there. I'm in, I go there a little bit sometimes in Wilton Manors.
Well, you know, I was in New York for like 28 years and then my parents became ill. So I moved back down. And then for a while I had, you know, I had a place in New York where I was moving back and forth. But then right before COVID, I sold it. And, you know, because we had a very small elevator. And people were getting sick from the elevator.
Oh, right.
And I had a dear friend die, really, from, she got sick and she died.
I'm so sorry.
From the elevator. So it's a deco building. It was a deco building. It's still there, but, you know, they only have small elevators. So it was very, you know.
Germy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was on the top floor, of course.
In the penthouse.
Penthouse.
Can't get rid of that taste for penthouses. Although, when you left the filming of the movie, you had to move out of the place, right? Or you chose to, rather, from what I understand.
I chose to. It was a very uncomfortable. It was cold in the winter and hot in the summer. It had a great view, but it was not a practical living space. And the super thought that, he developed a crush. So they gave him some beer during the during the filming, and he used to come and serenade under my window. There was no security, by the way. So I didn't feel really terrifically safe.
Wait, you actually lived in the penthouse apartments that you filmed in? That was your apartment?
You know, it's a very small budget movie, but my girlfriend lived there. She told me she was leaving it. So I grabbed the lease, and we had kind of set it there from the beginning. You know, we had an idea that this would be the place because she had told me she was leaving. Yeah.
It looked like it was, very high up. What floor was it?
28. We tried to get back up there to do like a documentary thing, and they wanted a huge amount of money.
As they do.
To let anyone back up there. They know.
Yeah, right. And which is probably
floors downtown. I mean, that must have been quite a view. That was really spectacular.
It was a really nice view, yeah.
Yeah.
I heard you describe it in another interview as beautiful but uncomfortable, which I think could also apply to most of the characters.
I was going
to
say, well, that's every apartment I've ever had in New York.
Yes.
Has either been comfortable but a shithole view or or vice versa.
There's always a thing at the end where so, well, but it's got a nice view or something like that, right? Like at the end, it's like,
you never get both.
I have to tell you, I've lived more disgusting places in New York than anyone so far that I've talked to.
Interesting. I wonder if you and James could have a gross off for apartments.
I lived for a brief period in the tenement hotel up in Harlem where Billie Holiday died.
Oh, wow.
And I could hear her ghost moaning in the hallway. Everyone just said that it was the drug addicts, but I knew it was the ghost of Billie Holiday.
Of course.
Of course, because she was moaning, why did I have to die here? And not in any of the other nice places that I stayed at.
And there were rats, and so I slept in the cupboard that was above the sink so that they couldn't get to me in my sleep.
I love all those little New York quirks about, like, well, I sleep up there because, you know, the rats can't get me, which is, you just don't hear that in that many places.
And there was this one rat that kept getting bolder and bolder, and he would come up to me. And, like, first of all, I'd have a broom, and I could sort of smack at him. Then he wasn't scared of the broom. And then he would come up, and he would just sort of stand there like challenging me.
Give me cheese.
That makes me think of another aspect of the film as well. There's you see it with Margaret, but there's sort of the more that comes at the character, and I think as New Yorkers, the more you sort of are inured to, and the more jaded you are in terms of danger in all of that, which especially seems to be the case in the late 70s and the early 80s in New York.
Well, it's also, you know, very much about trauma. So she's so traumatized, she doesn't feel anything anymore.
Well, right. Yeah. And every romantic relation is horrible. And and I love how it's pointed out in the speech when you're doing the glow-in-the-dark paint, if that's the right term for it. What is that?
Yes.
When everyone comes to New York,
That and then...
Well, my friend Marcel Fivet came up with that, and he was the makeup artist for Margaret on the film. He always thought in terms of what's going on and what are we going to do with the makeup. Yeah,
right.
I was taught to be fashionable, to be an independent woman. To be fashionable is to be androgynous, and I am androgynous not less than David Bowie himself. that is a fantastic ending and speech. It's just it's mind blowing.
Am I correct that Slava, is it Zuckerman? Is that how you pronounce Slava's last name? Slava Zuckerman. Is that the speech that he wrote kind of the day of to summarize things?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We were going to shoot the scene, and he said something is missing, and he wrote that.
Delicious. Oh, how boring.
And another aspect of one of the many that I love about the speech is that it kind of, it's almost like, is that all there is? The Peggy Lee number. Because, you know, in Connecticut, they trained you to do this, look for this Prince Charming. And I rejected that set of values. And I came here, it's supposed to be better, but it's no better. As we also see in quite plain detail with the horrible bullying and teasing that goes on in fashion show.
And it is which is worse? Is it worse to be bored to death, or is it worse to be bullied to death? You know, choose your poison, choose your death. It's amazing to me watching it. I watched it last night and again this morning, how you think that it's retro, but every one of the themes of gender fluidity, of sexual battery and sexual assault are things that are just, we are talking about now, 40 years later, that finally we're getting around to having this national discussion when we should have been discussing it 40 years ago.
Yeah, well, you know, this was happening for people that, were outside of society, but you could live in New York for very cheap then because nobody wanted to live there. It was a crime-ridden zone. So we all went out. Everyone knew that the club kids didn't have any money. So they weren't trying to rob us. So we ran around all the time in the middle of the night. It was, you know.
do you think that because New York is becoming a crime-ridden shithole again, that that has a possibility to ever happen again?
Only if the rents go down.
Yeah, yeah, and they don't seem to be, do they?
No. People need a cheap rent in order to be artists. They need space to work, and you know, unfortunately, it got too expensive for the people to stay there. They all left.
Yeah, yeah, it's a shame. Do you go back to New York? Do you still love it, or have you gotten?
I love it, but you know, when I sold, we just sold our apartment there. So of course I love it, yeah, but it isn't what it was,
and it's not,
you can't go back.
Yeah,
the both of you kind of have the, I remember James, you telling me that about New York. And when was the last time you went back to New York, James?
Right pre-COVID I went, and I think I mentioned to you that I go in for 3 days, I have a great time, and then on the fourth day I say, okay, enough. I'm a little irritated now.
and I never really had much of a New York experiences except going with my parents to, you know, see whatever at Christmas time. But then in the last few years, pre-COVID, of course, I had two solo trips, which were great. And I know a bunch of people on the Lower East Side and like go to Club Cumming. And now there's like the Q Club. I think that's the first mega club, especially a queer mega club, there in a really long time from what I know.
Oh, so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that the one that Lance Bass did?
Is
that
no, it's it is oh my God, I'm forgetting the name. It's terrible. I should look it up because you know who it is? It's Frankie Sharp, and one of the partners is Jake Shears and Charlie Carver. Okay. So it's sort of by the community for the community, which is nice.
That's nice.
It is nice. And but back to the speech again though, because and also earlier in the dialogue when the one of the awful men is asking you, I think the failed artist junkie, I forget the character's name, but the failed artist junkie who's making his wife's life misery now, because the film also talks extensively about toxic masculinity before, you know, there was a term so readily used for it. But when that character's coming over to score dope from Adrian and he's hassling you, and of course you mentioned a minute ago the super hassling you. So it seems like there was a lot of guys hassling you, which I'm sure you drew from quite a bit when you made the film. But it feels there's so many things to talk about. I feel like I'm cramming too many into one sentence, but I will get to this. He is sort of badgering you, or badgering Margaret, about whether or not you're gay, do you like men, and all this. And your character, and Margaret says basically, like, why does it have to be a man or a woman? I just like who I like. Which that sentiment also, I don't think I heard in a film,
yeah,
almost anywhere else.
Yeah.
Well, that's truly how I am. So, you know, at that time, I didn't know anyone else like that.
Right.
So it's nice that I can see people saying that now, and they don't have to choose, and they don't have to choose which gender. I think it's great. And I'm relieved that this is probably, you know, like people are finally feeling they can say that out loud and, you know,
yeah,
be who they are.
And that there are words now, gender queer and gender fluid and, you know, LGBTQ and all the different letters that weren't there when I was growing up, and that now if I would have known that there was something like, you know, gender fluidity, I think I might have had a happier childhood probably.
Yes, of course. At that time, to say you were bisexual is very unpopular, because to dykes it meant you weren't really ready to come out.
Yeah,
sure.
And they were trying to be, you know, like very strong and not to acquiesce. And so it wasn't a very popular term.
So
I think people believed that you were either on your way to one or the other, and that there was no such thing. It was sort of like you were copping out, and that's certainly not true. But that seemed to be the idea back then.
It seems like sort of a gang mentality, which unfortunately, as pointed out in the movie so many times too, no matter what's going on, people seem to slip back into this Lord of the Flies type of behavior.
Yes.
And it's particularly depressing when it's in already oppressed groups, and then there's further oppression within.
Yeah, within the group, yeah.
And so I imagine that experiencing that as well during that time before the making of the film, it must have been just further alienating.
Yeah, and I remember it was after the movie, and there was some kind of, was it ACT UP? It was some kind of political thing, and we were all on a roof, and they were going to close down one of the tunnels as a protest. And they said, okay, those of you who are not ready to go to prison should leave now because the FBI are here. And we're serious. We're going to do this. But they were like excluding all those who didn't want to go to jail to leave the room immediately.
Right. Because maybe you weren't tough enough. Because there's also that.
Yeah.
Because I guess also the craziness too was only exacerbated by the AIDS crisis and the lack of government attention in any direction. So extremism sort of pops up in.
But I do think that, you know, when you think about the scene where, you know, during the photo shoot when everyone is screaming, you know, singing Old MacDonald or whatever it was, and that there is always a sense of elites hazing the the new kids, or there's a lot of mean girl mentality sometimes downtown, and you have to be tough enough to
well, at least during the new wave there was. I mean, you hung out together, but you weren't that nice to each other.
Oh yeah,
there were some people who were nice, but not many.
It's very true. I mean, even I remember very much when I first came to town, and it was like during the Area time in Danceteria, and Area was intimidating. They were not welcoming here. Welcome newcomer. It was. They put you through your paces, and
yes,
you had to. It was trial by fire, you know.
Yes.
And that is sort of the way of downtown. I think it's maybe a little nicer now. I don't know. I don't know what the new kids are, but I imagine it probably.
It seems that way from.
I don't know. I have to tell you, I have space to work here, and I'm happy in making my things. But I am a terrible networker, and I have absolutely no. I don't know how to go about promoting myself in terms of my artwork, so I just make it. If you're not in New York, I guess there isn't any way to access that anyway.
Well, are you a social media person? Are you savvy on Instagram and Twitter and all that?
Not that savvy. I'm on Facebook, and I'm on Instagram.
Oh, you're on Instagram. Okay. What's your handle on Instagram? Because I think people would really like to follow you.
Yeah.
We can find that out later too and just add it in.
I think it's Liquid Sky.
Okay.
Liquid Sky. I don't know what it is.
Okay, well, I'll check it out and I'll put it in the episode description on the notes.
Okay.
Well,
you know.
Oh, and I have a website that I'm trying to make more usable, which is called AnnCarlisleGallery.com.
Okay, well, that's good.
Now, the way you described social media and everything and your sort of feelings towards it, networking, I heard another interview where you talked about the casting process post Liquid Sky, and it seems like there's a parallel there. Now, of course,
I went to LA and I didn't understand what they were talking about. I couldn't make any sense of it. I didn't know what they meant or what they wanted. I was so confused. I came there from the club world and I was like, what? It seemed like it wasn't based on talent at all, but connections. And, you know, it was very strange. And I knew I couldn't live there. So, yeah.
Now, what about the cachet from the movie? Did that help or hinder? Because sometimes it seems like when something is so unique and so brilliant, particularly in that era when there was fewer venues, right, to go to, you couldn't sort of be a social media presence or have a YouTube channel. Did that make casting directors sort of narrow cast you or put you in a box?
Yeah, they kind of put me in a box. But also, I have to say that I was in a box because the character was so close to who I was. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to break, and it wasn't. It was a creation, but it was also very close to me. So getting out of that and deciding where I wanted to go was a challenge.
Sure. Sure. Did you ever read scripts that you thought, oh, I could do something with this, but then it just didn't work out? Or did you ever find other material that spoke to you?
I read a lot of scripts that I could not understand what the movie was about. I couldn't figure it out because I was looking for something that was about something.
Yeah. Big mistake, apparently.
Yes. Yes. It was a big mistake.
I want to talk maybe.
And I would pass on them and they like, what do you want? And I just wanted something that was a script that was about something.
Yeah. Oh, and James, before we move on to that, which I do want to, I want to mention two of the roles that I'm familiar with from your post-Liquid Sky career. Miami Vice, because it's one of my favorite shows of all time. And that, I love your appearance on that. And then I was shocked to find out, I had no idea that you were the person in the bar in Crocodile Dundee in the horribly transphobic moment from Crocodile Dundee.
Uh-huh. What are you drinking, Gwendolyn?
Oh, no more honey, thanks, Mick. I must be getting on home.
Where's I'm, sweetie?
Just around the corner. I have a little place where I live all by my lonesome.
Not now.
Most of the time, that is.
Oh. Must get a bit lonely, eh? Hanker for a bit of mild company?
Do I ever.
Thank God. Excuse me, Gwendolyn. Don't go away, love.
All right, and I've been trying to tell you all night, that girl, she's a guy. A man dressed up as a girl.
That was a guy. Guy dressed up like a Sheila. Look at that. There you are, you.
Transphobic moment, and they couldn't find that he didn't want to touch a man. So they found me, who wanted to make the most beautiful man they've ever seen. I really wanted that character to be gorgeous,
yeah,
and seductive, and everything a transvestite can be. And instead of it being something, a moment to be, he put his fingers inside of me during the act.
What?
Take. He rammed his fingers up inside of me.
Oh my God.
Just got the Donald Trump move.
Yeah, well, Paul Hogan, all the stories about him just get worse and worse. This is the worst one, obviously, that I've heard.
Oh God.
That's horrifying.
It was horrifying, and I was very
understandably.
Upset. I was upset, but that was the end of the take, and then it was over, and I thought there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, what am I going to do now? You know, complain to the director? He probably told him to do it.
Well, yeah, that whole disgusting system of like, oh, that's the star and the co-funder of the film. What am I going to possibly do? You know what? Tell your agent, like, that's going to do something. Oh, she's difficult.
Yeah. I do. I want to say, though, when you say you wanted to make him the most beautiful boy ever, that Jimmy is one of the most beautiful boys I've ever seen on film. And just to see him, he's a horrible, horrible character, but damn, he's beautiful. Yeah. And he reminds me of John Sex. It's someone who
there was actually a boy that this character was based on.
Yeah.
And you know, he was an NYU student and a club goer, and we modeled together, and I wrote the part for him, but he was so unprofessional. He was too close to him and he couldn't play it. He wouldn't, he didn't show up for rehearsals. And
that's how you became Jimmy? Is that and then you said, "Well, I'll just step in and do it." That's fascinating. Yeah. Wow. And you did such an amazing job. It's funny to me because I see other beautiful boys that I know. I see David Ilku in it, and yes. Benjamin Liu, who I knew very well, Johnny Dinell.
Yes.
And then I also just remembered how much I fell in love with Tom Cody. Cody.
Oh yes, yes.
Oh, what a beautiful, beautiful boy that was. I don't think I'd ever seen him before, and I don't think I've ever seen him anywhere since.
Well, I think he died.
Oh, did he? Yeah, so many boys.
Drugs. I think he died from drugs.
Oh.
And Roy was in it, and he died from AIDS. Yeah, a lot of people died.
So many people did not, of those beautiful boys, did not make it through the 80s. Also, just very quickly,
take your time, James, because this is why I was so happy to have you part of this, because I had a feeling that you would bring a really terrific perspective to it.
Well, Paula, too. Paula is one of those great characters and one of the great faces.
You know, there was another person who was supposed to play Paula.
Really?
Wow.
But she turned it down. But she, you know, there's a person it was based on. Okay, so... she turned it down, but Paula did a fantastic job. Fantastic. But Paula was a fantastic actress. Nothing like this character. She was nothing like that character. And she made it her own, and she did a fabulous job. And then she disappeared. And she doesn't want to have anything to do with the movie now. Wow. I suspect she had a couple of children, and she doesn't.
Portland or something, isn't she now? She's like on the west. She's somewhere on the west coast.
Well, the last I heard, she was a yoga teacher on the west coast. But that doesn't mean she didn't go on with her life and get. You know what I'm saying? I suspect they didn't want us to contact them. The sister told us to leave her alone.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I don't know what happened. Maybe she became a Republican or something.
I hope not.
That sounds like there's something there where it's almost like with Syd Barrett and Pink Floyd, they couldn't mention the words to him when he was in the last 20 years of his life, because he would go into like a nasty, dark fugue state. So I don't know. That's what it sounds like. I mean, I don't know.
It's such a shame because she has that face that, you cannot believe she is anything other than that character. Like she does.
She was nothing like that character. She's just a great actress.
What was she like?
Tell me
about
her, because I'm fascinated by her.
And also the other aspect of her film career is because she's kind of a film legend, because her other role is Alice Sweet Alice, which is another great family film, by the way. So what was she like as a person?
Very talented, very easy to get along with, a very sweet lady, really.
Yeah.
And the spoken word that she did, the spoken word poetry and the my rhythm box and all of that.
Yeah.
Me and my rhythm box. Me and my rhythm box. And my rhythm box.
That was all written and rehearsed and everything, or how much of it was improvised?
Yeah, we rehearsed everything ahead of time because we had no money. Mm. So you can't improvise if you have no money. We were doing it on 35 millimeter. So you couldn't waste film. A lot of the work is one take.
Mm.
Didn't you say once you had one chance to get it right, and if you didn't get
exactly.
it right, it's still going.
One chance to get it right.
That makes the climbing up the ladder in the wedding gown very tricky, because if you tripped, what would you? I mean, like you
had to. And listen, that ladder had ice on it. It was cold.
Uh-huh. I literally, my heart, I was grabbing, clutching my heart, my pearls, hoping we were going to be okay. It was sort of reminding me a little of King Kong climbing up at the very end. Yeah. And then that dance that you do, that was spectacular.
It was on the edge of the roof and there was ice everywhere. And I really thought I might fall. I did. I didn't tell the director because I knew we needed the shot and, you know, there was no choices.
Was this the last shot in the schedule? Because you're like, well, if I go, I mean, at least it's good for the publicity.
Yes.
And was that a dance that you created? Who choreographed that or did?
No, I did all kind of weird dances in the club. I was a very weird dancer.
Oh, there was a chicken dance that everybody
did. Dance. Yeah, there was all these kind of weird dances I did all the time. So that was one of my weird dances. Ed Slava did tell me what he wanted. I knew they were going to edit it so it looked even jerkier.
And then also one of my favorite things is all your childhood pictures and your teenage pictures when we have the flashback. And it's so beautiful to see. Did they have to talk you into using real pictures or...
No, I had them. I let them use them. I am from Connecticut. I had all those like strange, I had a bunny.
I the thing about that really touched me the last viewing was everyone then starts to say, I'm from Philadelphia, I'm from this place, that place. And I think it kind of says, at least what I get from it is, look, we're all this, if you want to say awkward or cute, whatever, however you interpret those childhood photos, that's who we all are. And so then when we all attack each other as happens after that, because it seems like Adrian is envious of the seemingly normal apple pies on the porch scenario, because then she tells a story which is a horrifying story about her mother being out of the mental hospital and pissing on a bunch of strangers, and then says like, well, we'll beat that, where it seems like everything is just becoming a competition. There's just like no feeling other than anger and envy left, and then sort of what to do after that, when that's the milieu that you're floating in.
Yes. Right. What do you do?
What do you do? And then also the other aspect of that scene when everyone's singing Old MacDonald and everything. So Margaret is the object of everyone's gaze. And then the anger about that comes out in there, which is also seen with the men's gaze, because they're staring at her. They want her in whatever way that is, usually nefarious. And then when they can't have her, then it gets ugly because their will is being challenged.
Well, that is the story of female kind, isn't it? The beginning of time.
I don't know a woman who hasn't been brutalized in her life in some way or another. This is part of this heterosexual football mentality. This is America.
Right.
I wonder if something about the early 80s, how, we had just experienced the sexual revolution of the 70s, and it was sort of like popcorn popping, and everybody was trying everything and seeing how many boundaries they could push and getting hurt, but not really having time to pick yourself up and deal with it until a decade later or something, where I think people were...
Oh, look what happened. Women won the right to what? Be a housewife, service their husband, have a job, take care of the kids. They couldn't do it all. They couldn't do it all. Nobody can do it all.
Yeah.
There wasn't any freedom in that. It was like you still had to choose.
Yeah. But I wonder if people didn't have time to really realize what the sexual revolution would entail, and because it was happening so fast that I think a lot of boundaries were being broken, a lot of trust was being broken, that just in the name of being sexual, sexual freedom, that probably needed to be thought out a little bit more.
Yes. Oh, I agree with that. Yeah. And there's a lot of hostility in sex.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I love how that's presented when, especially when Margaret has, had it with Jimmy. And she's going to kill Jimmy. But she tricks Jimmy into thinking that Jimmy's getting his way, but also is taunting Jimmy because Jimmy's so broken and so obviously still suffering from masculine images or ideals, right? That right. to say you're a beautiful boy is that it's true yeah. and Jimmy's a beautiful boy, but Jimmy hates it. It can't stand that. So that's more, again, back to the self-hatred thing that I heard you mention in something else. I think that's fascinating too, to see the self-hatred in the characters.
Yes.
And he can't, he's terrified of what she's about to do to him. Like on some level, he knows that this is his end, you know, and everyone is watching him. And I kept thinking, how is he even going to orgasm? How is this even going to be possible? Because she's just coming for him like a shark.
And my interpretation as well, and I wanted to see what you thought of this, both of you, is that part of the reason he's so upset is that he might not be able to get it up for a woman, even though women are quote unquote gross and all of this, yet that is still so ingrained that that's what you're supposed to do, that is yeah. causing the schism.
Exactly, exactly. You got it. He doesn't know if he can do it, so he's, yeah.
Have any of these characters known like a moment of happiness? I mean, does Margaret ever, was she ever happy? Did she ever be happy?
That's a very good question. Hmm.
I want her to have had a moment of happiness.
No, I think that the creativity that goes into her preparing to go out, and demonstrating her artistic thing is, I mean, very freeing for all the characters, really, because that's the good thing about the new wave, was that everyone was trying different creative things, and it didn't really matter if you had done it before, you tried anyway. So that was freeing in the new wave.
I think you're right. I think there's a couple.
And there was a lot of sex workers in the new wave, by the way. A lot of women that were dancing were doing that so they could go out at night, so they could be part of that creativity, because they didn't have any way to make a living and still go out at night. I mean, didn't you find that? Maybe you didn't know that many women.
No, I did. In fact, I lived with some sex workers and who would do, you know, like phone sex all morning long and, you know, whatever to do so they could buy their outfits to go out at night, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There was a lot of that.
But I do think that there are a couple scenes where you see her putting on the makeup and drawing, and she's sort of lost in the beauty of what she's creating. And I think you're right. I think that is her moment of zen. That's her moment of happiness.
Even Adrian, because when she's punching her thigh and singing about Owen dead on the bed, that seems like the only time she's like kind of content as well. Yes. I mean, she seems to kind of get a lot of thrills out of being horrible to Margaret. But besides that, when she's singing Me and My Rhythm Box as well, which incidentally, you know, is a huge influence on a lot of electronic musicians, particularly like acts like Tracy and the Plastics. I know Fisher Spooner has listed the movie as being a big influence.
Well, you know, in November, they've invited me to come to New York. There's a photography show that's based on people that were influenced by Liquid Sky. So they're going to fly me there. I'm not Margaret. I don't know what they expect, but I'm going.
Well, they'll probably be nicer than the photo shoot in the film.
Yes,
Well, you know, I do know, talking about hazing people, I had a VHS copy, and if I would meet someone new, I would bring them home from the club and I would play Liquid Sky, and that was the litmus test. if they said, "Oh my God, that's so cool, I knew we could be friends." Weird. I don't get it. I knew they were out. So yes. I did a little of the Mean Girls too, using Liquid Sky
Well, I'm sure you were very pleasant about it though. I think that's a self-protection device more than anything else. James, how did you find the sort of sexual politic of the time when you moved to New York in terms of what we were talking about before with the sides taking people taking sides and the thought of bisexuality, etc.?
the sexual politics was not even really an issue when I got there, because there was, that just wasn't even there.
It was like a politics-free zone.
Like
Thanksgiving dinner, politics-free zone, ideally. But we were just saying about something and I forgot. But so I'm going to ask about drugs. Drugs, of course.
Segue.
Well, if you're not sure what to talk about,
let me get a drink of water before we stick with this one.
Having a lovely time, Anne. Thank you very much. This is a really wonderful chat. So
thank you.
Oh, I know. I've just been so excited all week for this. I'm so happy.
Same here.
This is my zen. This is my happy place now.
Well, same here. You know what I mean? And to be able to talk about this with the two of you is such a delight. Can you tell me about your drug experiences, Anne, before the film? Because it seems like there was all our research
everything.
Done.
I tried everything. I'm one of the lucky ones that wasn't, I don't have an addictive gene, I guess, because I tried everything. And once I tried it, I particularly liked cocaine. I really did. But, and I never bought it. People would give it to me so they could stand next to me.
That's a good confluence of circumstances. If you like cocaine and people want to just give it to you to stand next to you, that works out.
It's that Sid Vicious thing that I sort of experienced for a minute too, where it was like, I want to do heroin with Sid, man. You know, and like after my book came out, it was like, I want to do K with James St. James. So like, I never paid for it either. So,
which is good, because K is a little expensive these days. From what I hear, I wouldn't know personally, but.
So I did a lot of cocaine until the monkey study came out. It was the on the national news, and they proved that it was addictive. And I was so disappointed, because everyone had been saying, oh, it's not addictive. That was the song that you heard everywhere you went.
Yeah.
But apparently it is that the monkeys will do it instead of food, they'll do cocaine. So they die. And then I felt like you can't really do it if this is true. And, you know,
it's the Marlena Dietrich thing. She said, cocaine isn't addictive, darling. I've been doing it for years.
And you were, of course, a New Wave model, or as Rick James might have said, one of those girls you see in the New Wave magazines. I think you might be the only person I can actually say that to. So I felt it was appropriate. and you were part of the La Rocca agency, right?
Right. It was actually the brainchild of an artist, Nicky Carson. And he thought that would be a good idea. And it was for a while. It was a good idea.
Because that was the advertising made quite heavy use, right, of the New Wave looks.
Yes.
What were some of the... Oh, go ahead, James.
Well, I do have a question about the looks in the movie, because I remember 81, 82, that the New Wave looks and everything that was coming out. And I wonder how much of it was the vision of a hyper stylized stylist for the movie that then people were copying, or was the stylist copying the looks of the time? Which came first, the movie or the style?
Well, you know, Marina, who did the costumes.
Yeah.
She would say it was Russian. Okay.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But the makeup was done by Marcel, who did my hair for years before the movie came about. And I would be purple, or I would be red and black, and I changed my hair constantly. And I think there were different, there was different people doing different things, but the movie is also a little exaggerated because it's a movie.
Sure.
So the stylistic look is also to be more dramatic. So it's just exaggerated a bit.
Well, I wonder if Steve Strange or some of the New Romantics over in London, if they were copying the movie. Or if, you know, or it's, I don't know if there were just those ideas that were in the air that everyone was grabbing at and pulling down.
It's hard to know. Did Lady Gaga see Liquid Sky?
Yeah.
You know, how do you know?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Dale Bozzio, you know.
Oh.
Well, in particular, I'm thinking of that one woman in the fashion show who has this yellow plastic.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of shield or whatever behind her. Also, when did you first move to New York? And would that be when you were talking about when you sort of dubbed yourself an androgyne?
Oh, no. I moved to New York to go to the School of Visual Arts, and I graduated from there.
Did you have a main focus that you were doing? Were you painting, or was it?
I changed different things. I was doing video art at the point when they needed someone to stand in for a camera exercise. They were moving the camera and they wanted me to stand and move. They were doing tracking exercise. Okay. So I did this and they said, you did that very well. You should come to this acting class. So then I went to the acting class and I did a lot of work there. And I thought, well, this is kind of fun. And they said I was actually quite good. So then I kept going to acting classes. And I didn't go to this at the school anymore. I went to the night acting classes, which would get out at 2 o'clock in the morning. And those were Bob Brady's acting classes. Oh. And Bob Brady plays an acting teacher in the film.
Oh, okay? He plays Owen.
Okay. He also did the casting Owen. Or something, didn't he? Or mm-hmm. Did he do the casting or something? Or
he did casting as well.
Yeah. Uh huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you know, it's all interconnected that way. But I was always a painter. Before that, I did and then I did some video art, and that's how I ended up in the. Yeah, I was a painter, but and a sculptor, and I make small sculptures and. You know, you can see they're very strange. Mm-hmm. There's a set called Gargoyles, which you might find interesting.
Oh, that sounds good. Yeah. And we can check those out on your website, AnnCarlisle.net or .com?
Ann Carlisle Gallery.
Sorry. I just wanted to make sure that we really dragged the listeners' attention to it. That's why I screwed it up on purpose.
I do want to say, ask during this time, were you a Mud Club, Club 57 person? Did you go out?
I went to Mud Club. I went to 57. I went to Tier 3. I went to a lot of after-hours clubs that I didn't even know the name of.
Was there Berlin? Was that one of them?
I was out all night and I don't.
You were just wherever you ended up.
I don't remember. It was a really long time ago. I actually lived at night. I would go to sleep in the morning.
Mm-hmm. I remember waking up at 9 o'clock at night and starting to get ready at 10 or 11, getting a bottle of vodka and inviting friends over and going out at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Yeah. That's what we did.
Because to go out at midnight would be far too early. It'd be ghosts, right?
After a while, it became boring. I know that's hard for people to believe, but everything gets boring if you do it often enough.
Oh, yeah. And then you just have to either increase your drug intake or get out. You know, it's one or the other.
Yeah.
To keep yourself interested.
I decided that I might want to live.
Good thing. And we're glad you did.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the nocturnal lifestyle can be appealing at first, but then, of course, you're not getting daylight. And you're also, it's kind of similar to people who get stuck in working restaurant jobs and they only see the people they work with or the people that work at other restaurants when they go out to the bar afterwards or to the other restaurant that's closed so they can have drinks. You're seeing the same people. You're having the same conversations, I'm sure, et cetera. And there's only so much that can be alleviated by drugs. How many years would you estimate you lived in that night world?
Oh, that's hard to say. Because after the movie, then I started to do things in the day because I would have a photo shoot or whatever. And I was sometimes in the magazines and they do things during the day. But I had a girlfriend who was a new wave singer. So we also went out at night, but then I decided to go back to school And I went back to, I went to NYU for art therapy. So I chose a profession. And she wanted to stay in that milieu. So she left.
Did you always have a sort of, it sounds like you have a very strong work ethic, and that's probably what saved you from.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you did, even as a teenager and as a, you know, was when you first moved to New York, you were always focused on what you wanted and where you, how you were going to get it, as opposed
yes.
to drifting.
Yes. I like to work. Mm-hmm. I like to work on creative things and challenging things. So yeah, that's probably what saved me. I don't think it's healthy to live for another person. You know, I love people, but that's not a healthy thing. You have to live for some other thing, because people change.
Well, when the movie came out, I imagine that things got a little crazy for you, and there was a lot of attention paid to you, and it's sort of head spinning a little bit in the beginning, finding your...
No, in LA, I felt head spinning, like, what is this? I just didn't know what was going on. But...
Did people go bananas for you when you walked in the club after the movie came out?
Now, I was with my sister once, and we went to a club, and she said the crowd parted, but I didn't even see it.
That's interesting.
And your sister's in the film as well, right?
I was going to say, it's Sarah. Is it Sarah Carlisle?
Yeah, she lives with me now.
That's funny, because when I was seeing the credits, I saw Sarah Carlisle, and I thought,
was Nellie, you know, the interviewer?
Oh, and yeah.
Paula says she has longer legs than even you, Margaret, or something like that about her legs.
Yeah.
She was so happy I wrote that line.
Well, please tell Sarah that we asked you a lot of questions about your childhood. You know,
that's funny. But I liked that you didn't even notice, because I guess it was probably something that happened and you had just become used to it, maybe, or that you were.
Well, you know, I was always different going to the clubs, and I was always dressed oddly, not like everyone else. So it wasn't a new thing that I got attention for the way I looked.
Right.
No, it didn't feel that different. No. I was maybe a little less isolated because people would then talk to me. Whereas before, we didn't talk to each other in the beginning. We didn't. We just looked at each other and posed together if we liked each other. But it was just a lot of dialogue going on there. You want some of this would maybe be the only.
Oh, wait, is that Coke or K? Well, that sort of thing. Now, James, did you find that to be the similar sort of thing with the lack of chatting and all that? And also, I know that, you know, your famous associations with certain people did start out as sort of... not enemies, but rivals, if you will.
Well, let's see. You know, I was never a standing on the dance floor posing person. I always liked to find the little dark corners in the rooms off to the side where I could really lock heads with someone and sort of, you know, I was always trying to find the most interesting person in the room and, you know, unlock their secret of why they're interesting, you know.
Sure.
And so I was always trying. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there was always there was some tensions with some friends and competition that happened and people trying to outdress each other and outdo, you know, get more pictures taken or whatever. I mean, that was just part of the game, I suppose.
And I'm guessing also that you felt some of the enmity that Margaret in the film is shown feeling when, you know, you were, say, like either with Warhol or someone else that other people would wish that they could be with or be seen with.
Well,
or maybe I could be wrong. I'm not sure.
Maybe try and rephrase the question because I'm not sure.
Well, I think also because you have such a sweet nature to you, you do. You have like a lovely light that comes off of you, and
but
you're very inquisitive.
That during that time, we didn't have a sweet nature during that time.
Okay.
I was going to say that's something that's an affectation that I've acquired over the years.
Okay, so that's me. Pardon my naivete. Okay, trying to look through. Okay, I'll cut that.
I was a catty little bitch.
There we go.
18.
Okay.
Well, I was hell on wheels.
So maybe you were feeling the same kind of negative feelings towards others that I thought others might be feeling towards you. Now, but about Warhol, what was your feeling about the Warhol scene at the time? Did you ever intermingle with it?
Well, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about it. I mean, yes, people wanted to be close to him. But most of those people were ripped off. You know, they would have some really good artistic ideas and he would just take them and put his name on them. Yeah. So they worked for him. And Valerie Solanas shot him because he didn't pay her. He was using all her ideas and he didn't pay her. So she shot him. She was tired of being used. I mean, that was like, and I know people who were from that scene. And the guy who was supposed to play the junkie artist, he wasn't able to. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
So he was one of the Warhol people, and I guess he kept waiting for someone else to recognize. Mm. You know, there's a certain recognition that happened if you were one of Warhol's people.
I think like you talk about Valerie, and I know Holly was always knocking on the door. Give me my, I need rent money. I need something. And she would dole out, you know, $5 here, you know, after you using her in a movie or Jackie Curtis or all those girls. And they were used terribly. And I mean, they got something in exchange. I mean, you do get a certain cachet from having the Warhol stamp of, you know, approval, but I don't know that it was actually worth it in the end to hook your wagon to his star, you know?
It seems like, just from all the reading I've done, and particularly digging into the diaries again, that he had a very unhealthy way of using money as a tool to manipulate people, mm-hmm. to either curry favor. He would lavish money on certain people and then be very stingy with others. Really great qualities. But also it seems that in this scene in general, in that era especially, as evidenced by Liquid Sky, the best thing to do, and in any situation really, is not to hook your wagon to someone else's train, but to go make your own thing.
Your own star. I do think that probably what I remember of Andy, what I knew of him and everything, I think he probably would have been a little intimidated by you, Anne. I think that you were probably... a presence that maybe vibed with him.
Oh, he was shy. When I was with Ford, I met him at a party and I was introduced and he couldn't say a word.
Yeah. I'm sure that he was a little threatened, a little intimidated.
He didn't say anything. He didn't have much to say. there's a very nice piece that he has at the Dia in Hudson. It's a fluorescent light piece. It's really one of the nicest pieces he's done. And I'm always wondering who did it.
Right.
I don't know who did it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and he probably wouldn't have remembered either. He probably assigned someone, you know, at one of the factories and then, you know, put his name on it.
Yeah, there might be a receipt though in his hoarder boxes, or sorry, the archive. But about the making of the movie, I want to also talk about your collaboration with Slava Zuckerman and Nina. How do you say Nina's last name?
Nina Karova.
And how that came to be. Because I'm guessing that from when you were working on the video art stuff, and then I know you made a 8mm film after that.
Yes. And, it's called Fish. You're really well informed. Where do you get this from?
I like my information. You know, James knows. I'd like to see Fish. Is that available to view anywhere?
No, it was Super 8 and it kind of disintegrated.
Yeah.
And I tried to have it transferred, but it just didn't hold up. It didn't hold up, unfortunately.
Oh, that's too bad.
Well, Slava saw Fish, and then I was working with Nina, and her script was about orgasm. So then when Slava wanted to work with me on a script about aliens, I guess that got incorporated into, mm-hmm.
Alien whole, orgasms.
Yeah. So orgasm. So this it just happened. And it was a lot of hard work, but it's also a lot of fun. We laughed a lot when we were making
and I think,
writing that script.
It's also fascinating to me as well, the collaborative process that resulted in a script that has that speech that we talked about before, that until I found out who wrote it, I just assumed that was something you wrote, because the lines are so blurred as to what is from you and probably based on your life. And I think that's a great achievement in something. Like, you don't know sort of what is and what is not based on factual events.
Well, he had the look from the outside that I didn't have, right? Well,
sure. A proper alien. I mean, from Russia.
Right.
Well, you talk about laughing so much on set and everything. And I imagine writing...
Not on set. No, during the writing. No one laughed on set. Right. We were under so much pressure. No one, I couldn't breathe, let alone laugh.
But when you're writing it, because it seems like there's some in jokes there that I didn't quite like. What the hell was the shrimp lady? What the fuck is she? That's the shrimp.
Okay, I'd like two orders of shrimp fried rice, an order of shrimp and pea pods, an order of shrimp with lobster sauce, and an order of jumbo shrimp.
I'm sorry, but I'll be right back.
Uncle, don't expect me to wait for you. I don't like cold Chinese food. I don't intend to start liking it now.
I'm sorry, but duty is more important than shrimps.
Well, the duty is yours. The house is mine. And in my house, shrimps are more important than duty.
Like, I know that there's somebody had some shrimp someday or something happened, but I couldn't get it for the life of me.
Well, I don't know. Well, I thought it was funny. I just thought it was funny because
it is. It's crazy.
She's the very welcome light relief in the film. And also, again, we see all these different versions of courtship, and in this one, the guy is just not getting it. The scientist, he doesn't get it. He's got to go over and get stabbed to death instead of having sex with the woman. You know what I mean? Like, how is he going to save Margaret? I don't know. But, and she wants to go anyway. That's her Prince Charming up there, the Indian, as she says. I forgot until this rewatching, because there's so much going on in the film, that the woman who is with that off the junky failed artist who is, dispatched with earlier by Margaret comes to look for him, I gotta get him back. So there's a lot in the movie too about just sort of, as John Waters wrote in Female Trouble, heterosexuality is a sick and twisted lifestyle, right? Is that in that the line?
But heterosexuality,
heterosexuality,
the world of heterosexuals is a sick and twisted something.
It's a sick and twisted life. That's right, that's what it is. Yeah, that's right. So,
One of the things that I would want to ask about too, is the Desperately Seeking Susan, which now I have to go back and rewatch because I had forgotten that you were in it. And were you friends?
I had a very small part.
Are you in the movie theater? I'm trying to remember where you, what?
Oh, I play the girlfriend of Adrian.
Oh,
and I'm taking all the stuff.
And were you friends with Susan Seidelman? Is that someone who you knew from downtown?
No, I didn't know her.
No,
I had been on a modeling job, and I got an eye infection, and my eyes were like slits, So I asked to wear sunglasses, which is very weird when you're acting in a movie to wear sunglasses. But I didn't know if my eyes, they were shot, you know, from an eye infection.
Yeah.
So I didn't know, but actually during the shooting, they started to heal, but I had already started with the sunglasses. So.
Okay. Okay.
I wear sunglasses during the, nobody does that. That's
no, but it was the 80s and it was, you know, too cool for school. I wear my sunglasses at night. It True. Sort of made sense.
And a few more questions about other Liquid Sky projects. What was it like working on Miami Vice? Memorable or not? I don't know. Maybe it wasn't.
They both hit on me and I thought, oh, this is so corny and stupid. And I was nasty to them. I was very nasty to them. And they then, of course, they went out and I wasn't invited because I really thought it was too corny for.
And you were probably the only person to have ever been on the show and turned them down. Like, they were probably so used to women throwing themselves at them that you probably floored them, and they're probably still
no. And the fellow that played the
Philip Michael Thomas, Don Johnson,
the Hispanic guy.
Oh, Edward James Olmos.
He was such a gentleman. A nice person.
Oh, good.
And him I talked to. I thought he was a fabulous guy.
Oh, cool.
That's nice.
That's good to know.
He wasn't trying to slime me.
Yeah. Castillo. Yeah. He's a good guy. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, that makes me feel good, too.
Well, I'm trying to... Oh, and of course, and Downtown 81, which I haven't seen, but it's so legendary, I guess I should bring it up.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I don't even know where you can find it anymore, because I was trying to watch it for some other thing that I was doing because I'd never seen it. And
it's quite a ways before, that's really early on.
I'll see what I can do to find that, James, because, you know, I dig around in the dark recesses of the internet for various things. So I will check that out. And now
I've never seen it.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll send it to you if I find it as well.
Oh, yeah. I'd like that.
My pleasure. And
I'm sure Jean-Michel was probably just like an 18-year-old or 19. I mean, he must have been just a fetus when he did it.
Yeah.
Now, I heard something about Liquid Sky 2 as a possible project. Is that still?
Well, we started on the script and there was some interest, but, people have to put money up, and, you know, that's always the thing in low budget movies, right?
What if the aliens didn't disappear into dust? What if they were just beamed up into the spaceship and they've been in the spaceship this whole time?
And it's much roomier than anyone thought because, right? Space stuff. They can,
And then they're beamed back to Earth 40 years later.
Yeah. And they're like, oh my God, the rents.
And the heroin is powder now.
No, this stuff is garbage. We can't even. Well, it's been a wonderful time talking to both of you, and thank you so much for all your insight and everything. And is there anything anyone'd like to add before we close out?
I'm sure I'm going to think of 100 things that I wish I asked the minute I go to bed tonight.
I know. I'm sure I will as well. And one last note about the financing. It is kind of one of those bizarre things where this film made so much money, right, at the theaters. It ran for weeks and months at a time. Right? And I was curious about what the royalty structure was, because especially then, when it's hard to find out the information on that, did you and Slava and Nina...
Yeah, the trouble with low budget is that the exhibitors hold all the power. So they don't necessarily have to pay you for all these people coming to see the movie.
Sure.
Because you don't have a movie coming right back after it, like a studio does, and saying, right, you better pay us for this one or we won't give you the next movie.
Right. So it's good to know that that branch of show business is just as ethical and wholesome
as the rest of it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you both so much. And I'll let you know when this is up. And have a great rest of your day. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. So nice meeting you. I'm so glad
you as well.
That
yeah.
I was able to do this.
Thanks.
Today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good time.
God, it's lovely to hear.
Too.
Definitely.
Okay.
Sounds good. Okay. Bye-bye. Hey everyone, now this might sound like it's from the Body Double soundtrack, but it's not. What it's from is the soundtrack by Carter Burwell to Psycho 3. Carter Burwell did, I think, The X-Files.
Blood Simple.
What did I say? Blood Samples?
Body Double.
Body Double. I'm sorry. That's right. I'm a little woozy because we just taped an exhaustive movie club, and we, being myself and Jason Shahan, preeminent film critic at the Nashville Scene.
Yes, that's me.
And old dear friend. And so we just recorded that, and that's going to be coming your way very soon. How'd you feel about it, Jason?
It was great. I had a blast. I always do.
Same here. So we're looking forward to you checking that out.
Taxidermy. Like, is it a red flag? Is that a warning sign?
I would say yes, except I know that Goth Charlotte is, I think, into taxidermy, but she's also into spiders and all sorts of stuff. So yeah. I think it's a case-by-case basis. But if you're not if you're unsure about someone, you feel a little uneasy about them, you see that they are taxidermists as a hobby.
Yeah.
It's a big red flag. Yeah. Waving like Bono at Red Rocks. Yeah. it's a bit weird. Here's the weirdest thing about taxidermy as practiced by Norman Bates.
Yes.
You take your spoon, you dip it in the sawdust, you pour the sawdust into the dead bird, you fill the dead bird up, then you take the spoon, dip it in the peanut butter, wipe that peanut butter on a cracker that you then consume. That's a big red flag. Because you don't mix sawdust with peanut butter.
Maybe that's like a thing that the kink community in the mid-80s knew.
Or maybe it's like the Southern thing of peanuts and Coca-Cola.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, or salting a beer.
But like sawdust, that's like,
The spoon does seem to be pretty free and clear of the sawdust. But the fact that it's just probably touched the insides of this dead bird.
Yeah.
But they do show you symbolically that Norman isn't just this crazy psychopath. Because
the whole thing with the birds are great.
Yeah, because he has these dead birds that he's stuffing. And as he says in the first film, it's a way of preserving them or something. Yeah, he doesn't want to hurt them, but they're dead already. So it's a way to keep them alive. And that is the sort of...
Although there is poison in the bird feeder.
Oh, there is.
I mean, that's the thing. Because like all those birds come in and they eat it. And you're then
right.
They
drop dead. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
But one of them survives and he lets it go.
That's right. Because that's what he's collecting at the front of the film.
Yeah.
Off the ground.
That's how he makes his entrance.
Wow.
He's stepping over to the birds that have just left. And it does not, it's not, they didn't actually kill birds on it. There's like, that. I mean, they probably used tranquilizers. But, I mean, they did not actually kill birds on them.
Yeah, well, this was long after the era where they would actually do horrible things to animals.
Well, I mean, in America, there's...
Yeah, well, yeah. That's the only country, right? It's the only one that counts, pal.
Do you ever wonder how it would change the dynamic of this particular sad story of Arizona history if they had just put like a big beanbag at the foot of the stairs in Bates Motel?
You know, it really would have changed.
Because there's like three deaths that happen specifically just because of that staircase.
And the same shot. Do they use the same shot in Psycho 2 as a tribute?
Or I want to think so.
Clearly Perkins was doing... Yeah. Some camera stuff deliberately in tribute to Hitchcock. Also, there's really fascinating camera work in this. When
there's like one scene and it's towards the middle, I think.
Is he talking to Mother? Is this the one on the
he's looking in the mirror, but like you can't see his face. Uh-huh. You see that like the outline of him, but there's enough light coming from the other side of the room that you see his face lit in the mirror, but not in actual space.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's like, it's so visually like it's the kind of thing that like, you know, it would only take him like maybe 10 minutes to like block it out, but it makes such a visual impact on you.
Throughout the film, there's moments like that. Yeah. Like he'll step out of a pool of pinkish purple light and into green light. And of course, in color coding film stuff, that's how they call it in school, right? Just like image pretty more. Mm-hmm. the film stuff.
Let me tell you something about image pretty more.
So when you do film stuff, you want to make the image pretty more. And what you do is light pools. Uh-huh. And the light pool's got to be full of stuff.
Yeah.
So with Michael Mann's Manhunter, of course, the color coding is green and purple, unease, killers around, blue.
Means the Joker is nearby.
Yes, it does. It does. That's right. Yeah, and Tom Noonan pops out with his face fully made up, and you go, wow, okay, I never thought of him like
this. Oh, God, if Michael Mann had made a Batman movie in 1986.
Imagine that. Could you? That'd be great, because Dennis Farina would have been in it.
Yeah, Dennis Farina would have been Alfred. And, you know, like, well, I mean, if we're going with the, all right, so Noonan is the Joker.
Yeah.
Then William Peterson's got to be Batman.
He's got, and what's Batman's real name again?
Bruce Wayne.
Bruce, listen, you got to go out there and you got to clean up this town, okay? Listen, I've taken care of you since you were a little kid and I love you, but you got to get off your fucking ass and get out there. All right, no more cold soup, okay? No more vichyssoise. And he's smoking the whole time.
Of course.
Yeah, yes. Of course. He has to be.